Now it might seem from what Alistair was saying this morning that it was diametrically opposed to some of those things that I said and are in the bookie and we began to discuss in March. Although, as I see it, he's speaking about the beginnings of churches, the beginnings of two churches. Whereas I'm speaking from a point of view of a work that's gone on for 35 years and more. And I don't see any real contradiction between the two points of view. I could well believe that if Alistair stays 35 years in Western Wales, that what is accomplished then may look... Where are you, man? I want to see your face. may very well be like, although I would hope an awful lot better than Gilk. but something of the same order. And that would be my point. The thesis on the subject, both in January and in March, was that the church is essentially a family. And an awful lot that he said and that I say belong together. A family rather than an institution or an organization. That is fundamental. And that pressures of various kinds, and keep this in mind, you know, before the Russians come and all that, that pressures of various kinds, both from within and without the church, may oblige us yet to see this more and more and to take steps to reduce our ecclesiastical organization, at least congregationally, to the simple structure, but even then complex, of course, of a larger family. Or a series of larger families, or families going out from families, like you said, groups, you see, in that sense. With the chief and overriding motivation, of course, as I trust it is here, this is my desire. You spoke of this as a fellowship. I like the word brotherhood. Because there are two things bring us together here, and have done from the beginning. Been going over the history of this, when we started in this man's manse. The first thing is we stand together in the Word of God. And secondly, and this could exclude, and I think in a sense does exclude people in Scotland who stand with us in the Word of God, but who are not prepared to love one another. And so that's the next thing. We're a brotherhood, and we're here to learn to love one another, as well as to stand for the faith. And I hope that will continue and grow with the years. I say the overriding motivation is love to God, love to each other, bound together as we are in the service of God and the service of each other in the Christian church, and the service of the world in its great need. And it's clear to me from observation of congregational life generally over many years now, and this is almost trite to say, but I'm saying it, that the greater the love of God and of his word in a fellowship, and the more believers love one another, the simpler the running of the church becomes, and the more possible it becomes to run it as a family concern, and not as a mere business, or institution, or club. For, you see, this puts all sectional interests in their proper place, and unites the whole fellowship, if not the whole congregation, yet, in one big, happy family. Happy families, of course, have their troubles, as we know. But one big happy family in which age and sex and class or any other division find their subsidiary places in a loving complex, and in which an increasing sense of personal, and this is the fruit of it, An increasing sense of personal and individual responsibility leads to an increasing number undertaking service. Produces leadership on the basis of privilege rather than duty. Now, in the paper, a good deal was made of the role of children and adolescents as being brought up according to the covenant, and this is the point at which we stuck in spring. Being brought up in Christ and not out of him. Great many in our denomination, great many evangelicals in our denomination, don't know that. Some of them don't want to know it and don't agree. They agree with the Baptists much more than they agree with us. And this must change, I believe. Because the more you dig and delve into our doctrine and see it working out generation after generation, the more convinced you become that we have something from the Word of God, never mind the confession, that these other dear brothers and sisters don't begin to see it. It's so marvelous to see the working out of the covenant in Christian fellowship and in families of families. The faith of godly parents taking firm hold of the promise and provision of the covenant, and on that firm basis refusing other than that their children will grow up in the Lord and for the Lord. Are we not taught the strength of this in the parable of importunity at midnight? Wherein the needy man, whose need was in respect of others, never forget that, that's very important, I think, in it, the needy man simply plasters the Lord with prayers in the high desperation of faith, in a way that has absolutely no alternative. He insists on being heard, and he will make a row until he's heard. Now, some people, I think, would think that wrong in respect of their own children. They would wait to see what God would do. What God has done. God has said, and God has done. He says, it's up to you. No. On the basis of what I've said and given, it's up to you. Believers may say that they haven't got that faith, that kind of faith for their own children. And that they have less than that faith as pastors for the children of others in the congregation. All right then, I think that means that such are not able to stand upon God's covenant. And then the onus must be upon them, upon us. Within the Lord's will, of course. The onus can never be upon him. He has given and he has spoken. He has done, like Mary of Bethany, he has done what he could. Now, I'm not ignoring election in the subject, but even election works by faith, doesn't it? It's no other way to work, and seeks no other. And if this hurts us, as I'm sure in spring it hurt some of the women folk, if it hurts us all to face it, then so be it. God can use that, I believe. I can only confess to having seen this doctrine work out increasingly with the years, until whole families become more and more involved in the total life of the congregation, when extraneous aids, such as sectional gatherings, which I regard as quite different from outreaching groups, quite different, sectional gatherings and peripheral activities, particularly for the young, become progressively unnecessary. And notice I say progressively unnecessary. The sole attraction, and I use the word attraction advisedly, is Christ in the midst of a loving, larger family. Family which is inclusive rather than exclusive of every legitimate aspect of healthy Christian living. No narrow-mindedness. drawing people in, patient with them, caring for them, into the family. One of the most intriguing features of this, as those who take the trouble to come to our place and see and experience the fellowship for themselves, one of the intriguing features of this is the natural participation of even little children in the whole congregational life of the family, including the congregational prayer meeting, who take part just as naturally as they do at home by their bedside or round the family board in the bosom of the domestic family. Why shouldn't that be? A number of visitors throughout the summer, and this is not new, have declared that their hearts have been melted and they've shed tears as they've heard little ones speaking up along with their daddies. Lovely to hear one family. Daddy prays first, and then mummy, and then the older girl, and then the younger one. You see? And the whole thing is so beautiful, it just touches the heart. It has also something very challenging to say about little children behaving and listening in church, because they are taught and trained toward that end, first at home. I'm talking, of course, about children who belong to Christian families, as practically all our children do. And of course, that's the result of many, many years. Now, I know that to present such a view of congregational life, even if you agree with it, not forgetting that under atheistic domination it could be the only form of Christian lifestyle that there might be, even if that, such a view of congregational life, even if you agree with it, is a far cry from congregational life as most of you may know it. And I quite recognize that we may have to begin about a million miles from the ideal, and none of us are near the ideal. And all I plead for, this is where I stand with Alistair, whether he stands with me there or not, I think he would, is that we're working towards some kind of an ideal as that. And if that is accepted, then we can begin to work out details in very, very different situations. And our discussion can be most usefully directed towards mainly long-term means to reach such an end. The history of our church at home in Aberdeen is only one of surely many ways of attaining this. And I don't see, honestly, why it should take others. If I may break in, the whole question of reactions that was raised and that I chipped in about, you see, indicates something. There was a fierceness of opposition to the preaching of the gospel in our place, such as I have not known in any of your churches. The very devil himself, horns and all, was in the hearts of some of these people. And those who were there at that time, one or two here, could testify. Willie Leslie, if he were here, he could testify to that. There was a quality of demonic and satanic opposition to the whole thing, which I now see was the devil's resistance to something that might in some ways point the way forward. I say the history of our place at home is only one of many ways of attaining the end of a Christian church, truly becoming a Christian family. And I don't see why it shouldn't take others, as long to accomplish anything like it, or the beginnings of it, as it has taken Gilcomston to approximate to it. What do you think?
Well,
take this over.
Increasingly, what you have to say, Mr. Stell. I think that even yesterday I had some children sitting in front of me in the church who were, I noticed, looking up the references to the preacher. I mean, they were just very young kids, but they were busy looking up the references in the evening service, you know. And kids from pagan backgrounds came in. I mean, it isn't just the children of Christian parents are from some, it's amazing that some of these children from pagan backgrounds can come in and start being part of the family.
Mr. Still, I wonder if you could say something about the place of sectional groups within a congregation, how helpful or how damaging they may be. Thinking especially of young women's groups and women's guilds. In our congregation, a young women's group is a great problem because it takes one limited age bracket of young women and sets them apart. And they become cliquish and they're set against the older women because they're not members of the guild and they're set against the rest of the congregation. Now, could you say something of your experience with these sectional groups in the church?
All that I think I need to say, Alistair, is that it takes time and it can take years to merge our congregation, which is a clutter of groups that scarcely ever meet, some of them don't even come to church, you see, takes years, I would think, or could take years, if the Lord could do something extraordinary, to render a great deal that happens in these groups unnecessary. That's not to say, that's not to exclude a very great deal of outgoing and service, you see. The whole point of the family, the larger family, is as they become increasingly responsible, they assume greater responsibility for leadership, as Alistair was saying. You see, he was saying that what he does now compared with the first little while at Gala Shields, and this is a case. You see, you've leaders all over the place who can lead things. All sorts of things can go out from a family fellowship, but they're not organized and controlled by the minister, except through the ministry and his influence. But the important thing is, you see, that the whole family meet together on the occasions when the congregation meet. In our case, it's four times a week. And everybody. The one exception, everybody comes to those. One exception is lots of the older children who have homework find Wednesday evening Bible study difficult to come to. But Saturday, Sunday, both services, all are together, and it's out of this family fellowship, grandfathers and grandmothers and parents and children and visitors and students and nurses and all that together, milling together, just make a larger family, and an awful lot. You see, people will say, some of the ministers nowadays say, oh, nothing happens in Gilcomston except Bible study and prayer. And yet, when one of the chaps in a broadcast service hit out terribly at us a few years ago, not by name, but he did, saying there's nothing there but these things, I know the congregation well there, and I made some inquiry into the outreach of their congregation into the community. You know, medicine, social service, nursing, all that kind of thing. And then looked up the list of the the involvements of our smaller congregation, the smallest congregation in Aberdeen, are pretty near that. Now, the involvement of our people in service in the city and beyond, it would have given him a red face if I'd told him that. You see, but it all issues. But
would you say then that these groups that are limited to one age bracket or one particular sex are actually damaging to this family attitude?
Not necessarily.
Well, try and discourage them.
I think they can be very much not necessary. As with other things, more embarrassing than a group like that, who can be perfectly innocent, can be very useful and very blessed if it's not cliquish and interned. As with other things that can be embarrassing, the things that happen at church halls that are really ungodly. I think when one goes into a situation, we've said this here in this group so very often, you go into a situation and you start where it is. You start with your people where you are, and you get to know what they are, the whole background and the history, and you start where they are. You don't go in as I did, like a bull in a china shop, and turn everything upside down. Some of you who hear about our place now wouldn't believe that that was the case, but it was. You don't do that sort of thing, and I would disadvise anyone from doing that, but if the Lord has put you there to do a job, you wait to see him put aside and let die things that are inconvenient. And there's many a one sitting here, others who are not here today, who could testify how the Lord has done that, and things that were inconvenient and embarrassing or unuseful were in the end, sometimes pretty quickly, just faded out.
Mr. Still, some years ago I had a child psychologist answer a question from the father of an autistic child. The autistic child had a belt which she held by the buckle, in which she was wont to take into supermarkets and other such places. And when you swing that round your head in the supermarket, you can imagine what happens. Yeah. And the father said to this professor of child psychology, what do I do? Oh, it is very simple. You take off half an inch each night, and from having a belt that length, the suits come to have one that length. And that's what I call graded change. Graded change of an officer.
Mr. Still, what would be your advice to a congregation where perhaps the Guild of the Young Wives for the men's group is Christian already and is aware of not being interned or exclusive? Would you gradually close them down or ask them to phase out or what?
I wouldn't want to close down anything really, although I have done in my day. I wouldn't want to, and if it can be incorporated into the life of the congregation, and it is really a family. That's an ideal in any congregation that I know with these groups, because they can be so sectional and so opposed to one another, you know, fighting about halls and accommodation and all sorts of things. Even the best of them. But you see, ultimately, the worship together and the ministry of the word, and then the fellowship. That's very important. When we threw out our pews and made our place suitable for social fellowship, always after the worship and the preaching of the word, then that was so psychologically satisfying, socially satisfying, that you kind of get people out of the church. After the morning service, I get home to lunch at 2:30. And I got home last night at 11:45, and that's normal.
You need some great change, Mr. Stewart.
I think that's a very important point. I've obviously been through Gilkenston, Mr. Stewart, and that was one of the first things that really made an impression on me, was that people showed an interest in me as a person when I first came there, and there was this opportunity to hang about that people didn't want to go. And I get the feeling that many people, for many people, the penny hasn't dropped in that area. I believe, you know, I was trained as an architect, there's a relationship between the spiritual teaching about the family and the creation of a family environment. And our buildings speak as much as our message. And if our building is a 19th century building, which is more like a poorhouse than a gathering for a family, your family preaching is going to be retarded. You're not going to make the impact, because the word has to be made flesh, in a sense, in your buildings. And we can, if I talk about church history, architectural history from that point, it's very, very true how theology has been reflected in architecture throughout the years. In the Middle Ages, great big temples, because God was remote and nothing to do with people. We've got to create environments for people to have fellowship in. And if we're going to preach on the family, we've got to burn our boats and burn our pews, as you say.
There's a tradition, you see. Is it particularly so in the Highlands? I've just been in the Highlands in Gaelic with dear John Smith. You would think as soon as the benediction is pronounced, that everyone was terrified they might speak to their neighbour and fly, literally fly, until with two or three moments afterwards there's nobody left but church officer, there is one, you see, and the minister. What to do with them? Do they know one another too well or what? But you see, that can only grow where there's a sense of the Lord being there and his loving presence there, and the people there being loving, you see, and waiting and glad to speak to people. Frank said yesterday in intimations, doing them for Willie, that he hoped, and he put this very beautifully, he hoped that they would wait after the service and give us a chance to meet them and chat with them and have a cup of tea in the evening. That kind of thing.
We are going to have to wait a while before we get rid of our pews, I think, because that suggestion has been mooted once or twice and has been fairly definitely squashed. But in the meantime...
Yes, but you know, I don't want us to descend to that level of discussion of the thing, you know that.
In the meantime, we've done something which I think is much more important in a small way, in the same line. And this involving ladies of the Women's Guild standing at the door on Sunday morning and welcoming people to church. That's made a significant difference to our congregation. Couldn't get men to do it, and men weren't very good at doing it anyway, but the women are very good at doing it. And make people feel at home as they come in.
Something that I've done for the last few years, I find very fruitful. Of course, we came to a point when, you know, when the youngsters were very way out in their dress, worse than they are now, I think, and very way out, and came in droves from the residences, university residences. It was quite clear that if we didn't really unstarch ourselves, they wouldn't draw their friends into the kind of thing we're having. And so we got rid of all the formalities. We couldn't tear down the pulpit and all that kind of thing, but I started conducting most of the service from the table, and no more robes, no formal entries. I just saunter in about 10 minutes to 11. And go around the church and greet visitors, you see. Now, the interesting thing is, we have a unique privilege in Aberdeen, our organist, who at least creates half of the spiritual atmosphere in the church, as anyone who's been there knows, Gordon Ross. And even although people are chatting quietly to one another, you know, there's an awful row in some churches, I think it's appalling and abominable, but... people will be greeting one another and talking quietly, and I'll go around and greet people and this kind of thing, and yet the whole thing is in an atmosphere of just such a sweetness and a sense of worship long before we begin to sing the opening song. But this kind of thing, many, many visitors have remarked in this, you see, the minister, instead of coming remotely from his vestry all dressed up like a clown, is one amongst the people. Some of them have said to me, well, one wonders when the minister call will come off on a Sunday morning. I don't know, it comes off on a Sunday night. But these things, people see. These are little things, and I said, but they see. That you're wanting to be one with them, that you're human and friendly and this kind of thing. And you can do it so many ways, the women that do it, this is fine, or whatever, it doesn't matter what you do. There's so many different things we can do. If we have the will, if we have the vision, as Alistair was saying, the vision to make our church a family.
One of the problems, I think, still is the sheer commitment of time that people have. And I think while the organisational life of the church can still be quite healthy in itself, the guild or the women's deal or the women's group or whatever, very often that in itself has a priority of commitment of time in the minds of people, over and above perhaps even the second Sunday, back in worship on a Sunday, or being part of a prayer group, or part of another group where we might learn and Bible study together. And this is perhaps where an area of simplification is important. How do we get over to people that the continuation of the women's guild and the women's group per se is not the priority that we ought to be involved in, rather things that maybe are more important.
Yeah.
I find that there's a mental block there, that has the priority of time.
I would think this will just take time as the life of the congregation or the life of the worshipping people becomes warmer and freer, you see, and then people talk, you see, and people are drawn in. Some who would go to women's guild would seldom go to church, and other things, you see, Sunday school teachers who are never in church, and things like elders who only come when they're collecting or something of this kind. That's bound to take time, you see. And I do emphasize this because we are talking about time. What did I say yesterday? That God made time, and he uses it. You see, and it takes time. And so that Rome wasn't built in a day. I do think that chaps today in a different climate from 35, 40 years ago can speed their progress in a congregation evangelical wise in a way that we couldn't so long ago. The climate has somewhat changed, so I think some of the changes can be more rapid than they seem to be then, but it still takes time to change people, because this is the great thing, you know. When you some of you maybe preach a whole day, you've two services, and you go home and not a soul has said a thing. You felt maybe the liberty, you felt the Lord was with you, not a soul taking the slightest notice. You don't know if anybody's the slightest bit the better. You just committed to the Lord, and in the fullness of time, if the Lord really is with you. Two-legged chair. Okay, go on then.
I'm very concerned about my congregation in one particular area, which is the boys' brigade. I find it so formal, so cold, that the leaders seem to find it impossible to warm in any particular way. And what concerns me even more is to hear recently that the Boys' Brigade movement is hoping to continue the Boys' Brigade into a kind of adult BB. And that worries me very much.
They have old boys' associations in many places, do you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is something we're hoping to promote more, and it seems to me that it's going to create a kind of parallel church. But I don't know how one overcomes this in the individual congregation. This terrible formality. And, I was just getting at my readers the other day in a hope a gracious kind of way, pointing out that in 8 years we haven't had one boy coming into church membership or indeed into church worship.
That would be largely their fault. It's the quality of the leaders or lack of it that tells. George, Philip and I could tell you a very exciting story about Boys Brigade. I suffered the Boys Brigade for 7 years, and then we went down and put them out, because the officers were putting the boys, deliberately putting them against the preaching of the gospel and coming to church, except when they came as a parade, you see. And it just went on, and it couldn't go on any longer. But there are other situations. George, you've had a Boys Brigade for quite a few years. It's just folded up or blended with somebody else.
Oh, no, they were the focus of a very definite anti-gospel. For about 14 years, perhaps, we had Boys Brigade, and not a single boy in all that time came to church, the same as you're talking about, let alone became members. And the reason simply was that the officers, with one significant exception, the officers who were mostly elders, were totally opposed to the gospel. My wife used to sit behind the rows when they used to, in the early days they came to church, latterly they didn't at all, and on one occasion I was speaking about the cross and about conversion, and my wife watched the BB captain nudging both an officer on one side and a boy on the other to get them to laugh in the context of this.
This pain, if I may say this pains Gordon Ross very much, because he's very much a BB boy. And the BB, you see, in Aberdeen Tenerife, I'm sure in Glasgow and many other places in the old days, was a different thing, because the Boys Brigade provided the deacons and the elders for the church in the old days. There's no doubt about that, was there, Gordon?
That's true.
But you see, the Boys Brigade, like so many other things, has degenerated spiritually and even morally in Scotland, although there's a kind of a revival of it in England, which is interesting. I mean, in comparatively evangelical churches, there's a kind of a revival of the Boys Brigade. And I think the day for uniform organisations is over, really, in the climate of opinion. But there's no reason why there shouldn't be a thoroughly evangelical. Who has one?
There is actually. I got a letter just recently from a friend in Northern Ireland who said that at this year's Boys Brigade camp, 20 boys were converted.
Yes, and I know the situation's different in Northern Ireland.
But there is the campaigners' organisation. Is a uniform evangelical organisation.
Yes, yes.
Jokumson Park Baptist in Aberdeen.
Yes.
I've got that started in place of the Boys Brigade.
Yes, yes.
They had Boys Brigade.
But it's just the uniform, I think. Yes. That's old fashioned, but that's just my opinion.
I think one of the problems with the uniformed organisations is that they are part of a great structured thing within every city.
Yes.
And therefore, there is a whole ramification of responsibility and commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Over all the years, we never got any boys from the Boys Brigade to come to church, let alone become Christians. We never got anyone in the guides to come. Since we abolished that, and we've got a boys' club and a girls' club, largely bringing kids in from the immediate area around about the church. We find that we're able to get some of them to come to church.
But these are definitely led by Christians.
Oh yes, and with both lots, in the middle of the evening, not by way of an epilogue at the tail end, at the middle of the evening, all the activities stop, and they have a straightforward Bible study led, conducted by the leaders, really an exposition followed by discussion, and then only after the stipulated time for that they go back to the remainder of their activities.
Mm-hmm. Alistair, what about your place in uniformed organizations?
We have everything.
You have everything.
Scout, Brown, Lord, BB. But, and I would think that we find that all these things happen around us without very much substantial difference to the main congregational life. I think we would see them really as aspects of service to the community, and at the moment we haven't been able to really thoroughly integrate them into the life of the fellowship. I would hope that perhaps one day that would come, but we look on it, I think, really that way at the moment. And many of one of the troubles really with guides and brownies and BB to some extent is that you don't have a great deal of control in the matter of who leads them. You can be difficult and insist, but it just causes ill feeling. And at the moment, we're up to starting tonight a new organisation for 12 to 14, which will be a kind of Bible club, which is named at the moment, but will be run more along lines that you would be happy with. Christian leadership.
You've chosen leaders, yes.
But one would just need to wait and see how it develops. I just don't know. We feel very discouraged, I think both Chris and I would feel very discouraged about the long-term future of some of these organisations which just exist all around us, gathered over.
Is that a pretty general feeling in the land? Anybody quarrel with that?
I would agree with you, Mr. Still, that it depends on the leadership. I can see a difference, for instance, between us. But we, in our white brigade company, we're a very large white brigade company, we have a couple of men who say are Christians, and yet the rest of the staff are very loose and in their connections with the church at all. And I think I've tried almost everything there to be involved with them, to do teaching, take older groups myself. We now have them coming into church once a month as a whole company, which is just one way of bringing them in. I've been on BB camp with them. And yet, even over 5-6 years, I'm like, say, with my friend here in front, I think I can maybe count one or two people who come. Christians and the church very little. But comparing that, for instance, with my guide company, where the guide captain is a committed Christian and her two lieutenants are also. And she has done a tremendous amount to get her girls in the church. And that's a young division, getting them into the church and also into another group, which is Junior Youth Fellowship, which we now have under my own leadership, the one she was. And she's done a tremendous amount to Arjuna in that right direction, and I'm sure you're right, the leadership is naked of religion.
Then there's also the factor that they're associated with the general organisation in a city or community. They can be influenced by them. See, the Boys Brigade, the influence of the Boys Brigade headquarters in Aberdeen is poor. A good company. Is there a good company run on evangelical lines in Aberdeen? I don't suppose there is, Gordon.
I'm not aware.
Tory used to be.
Yes, the Tory.
But you see, they have all sorts of activities. Lot of dancing for quite young boys, you see, and I'm sure there's drink too, you know. And this is not good. They encourage the youngsters to this kind of thing.
We've insisted, Mr. Still, that the boys and the boys brigade come to the ordinary Bible class, the no separate Bible class. This has been a great help.
Yes. Yeah.
Mr. Still, I feel burdened to say that just having come back from a superb week in Aberdeen, I've come back with my eyes widely open. I've heard you often talk to me privately and at these meetings about your children, your young people in Gilkenston, and I was going just Father God, to see this, and I've never seen anything quite so super in my life. I've been in St. Michael's, York, and all the rest of it, and you frankly can have it for me. The morning service last time I was there was just a hubbub of noise from beginning to end. I sat in Gilkison yesterday, and in the evening particularly was impressed by the young children, a little girl, beautifully behaved, about three seats in front of me. She'd be no more than four or five, unless I'm a hopeless student of kids' age, being a bachelor, probably am. But she sat there, and she had a little book, and she was writing things, and occasionally would show them to her parent. I think it was a father sitting next to her. And these kids were just magnificent. I had never in my life seen children behave so excellently. And again at the prayer meeting, their prayers, and just their presence, and the sweet smiles that they gave to myself as a visitor. I could have been laughing at me, I don't know. But, you know, just the whole atmosphere is so gracious, so powerful. And if anyone ever says to me in Jedburgh again, that you can't get children to sit through a 20-minute sermon, when I saw some sitting through nearly an hour last night, without moving. And it was powerful ministry, it was deep, it was adult, it was beyond that. And these children were there, and heart and soul involved, and running about the church playing afterwards, so happily, till all hours of night. I don't know how I could get this to work in Jedburgh. I've been there 13 years yesterday, Jim remembers. Happy birthday to you. Well, you weren't saying it, so that about said itself. I could think of only probably one family though in our place, my Session Clark's boys, and they're getting on now. One of them's 15, the other be about 13, and the other 10, 11. And they might be capable of sitting through, but some of the incoming Christian families, don't throw me out, but some of them from Baptist traditions, they can sit still for 10 minutes, never mind an hour or an hour and 20. I've got children brought up in a Christian home, and I love them, but they get ushered out before the sermon when there's no Sunday school to play in the park. They can't sit through it. I think that's pathetic. Now I'd like to see with all my heart, not a mini Jochumsen, but something like that starting in our place. Oh boys, oh boys. How to get it going I don't know, but I just want to back up everything that's still said and to say how terribly impressed and blessed I've been by the whole thing.
I wonder if I can just say, try and or say something towards your final question, Mr. Stilwell, whether this thing can be done more quickly now than it could in your day. My own experience is that it's taken just as long, if not longer, in my own congregation. Mm-hmm. But maybe it can be done quicker, but obviously, perhaps in some places it can. But I think that the time scale is not shortening for this process of spiritual development in people's lives, not in my experience.
I suppose there are different ways of starting ministries. It's interesting, interested to hear what Alistair said about starting right away in preaching, you must be born again, and being straight and plain and forthright, because that's the only thing he could be, and of course the Lord would use that, and that's certainly how I started those many years ago. And although I regret things that were done, I couldn't see it could be done otherwise, because the Lord was just driving me on. It simply had to be. I think of one or two places where a man has gone in all quietly, you see, and worked away. I can think of one or two examples, one or two not here anymore. And I really think that these chaps should have gone and stood their head or something, done something. My desire is to say, for goodness sake, do something unusual, attract attention, draw people, do something. And I think in many places you need to do that, you need to get a start. As I say, I went home to Gilkemson from Glasgow on the 7th of May 1945, the first night that the lights went up after the war. You see, so that helped me. You see, the whole country was agog. But within a week or two, we had banners across the street, and we were kicking up no end of it in one way or another. Tremendous things, and putting up boards and text on the board was shocked people, and all sorts of things to get a start. And I now see that that was the Lord's way to get a start. Now, everybody couldn't do that, and that's not necessarily the way to do it. But I think, going into it, you've got to do something. You've got to get a start. Yes?
Can I just say that I've only been at Calder Crooks for 4 months, and the Lord has brought me into that place to build upon another man's work, Jim Martin, who's now a cropped foot. But when Jim Martin was there, he was very much an evangelist, and quite a few people, whole families, were converted under his ministry. And now this has been given to me. And I find that there's a real desire amongst family units for this kind of corporate sense of belonging. And it's really quite wonderful. Jerry, when you did supply for me, you sensed something, you said something to me about that family atmosphere, and they bring their kids along in the evening, and the kids just sit there, and they may not take it in, but they bring the books, and it thrills me, because what you've been saying today and on previous occasions is beginning to flesh itself out in my own situation. I know it's quite different from a lot of others, but I sense this kind of expectancy on the part of Christian families that they want this. They, you know, they want this kind of nurture. And all I can say is thanks for this kind of guidance, because it's really invaluable.
But then, Bob, you see, a family has the beginnings of it. They are a family, you see. And they come together. It's great to see the different ages, you know, father, mother, and all.
Can I just say that on one occasion I took the opportunity of speaking about the church's life as being a family affair. And I didn't think it was anything all that great. But afterwards, the amount of feedback that there was just about the idea itself, that it is. People see that it's a family affair, and I think more and more people want that to be reaffirmed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And said, yes, that is right.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that.
Yeah.
Is it right?
That's good. Well, this is the chief point with Alistair this morning. My heart is just absolutely tuned, because this is the thing, however you do it. But by the way, I think we shouldn't miss the significance of Largs. You know, God chose Largs. Were you the first, Bob? You were the first, and then Jerry, to do two different churches, and then Alan. Now, isn't there somebody following?
Leslie Steele.
He was there. He was in 72.
Ah,
yeah.
And isn't there somebody else?
Reg Campbell is down the border. Reg Campbell.
Yeah. God has purposes. And you can say that now, the reaping the fruit of these ministries, can't you? Tell us a wee bit, Alan.
Oh.
Go on. Now that you're seated in a four-legged chair.
Well, I can only speak about the one congregation, St. John's, really, although I have, there's another evangelical followed, Bob Nelson, at St. Columbia as well, which is tremendous.
Who's he?
Alec Muir.
Yeah.
Did his training in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at St. John's, we have found amongst the born-again people that there's a real hunger for the kind of warmth of fellowship that we've just been talking about just now. And at the midweek Bible study, we're very much developing that sense, and we have 30 committed folk who come along who really want to put into practice what's being expounded from the Word, which is really super.
Can I just put in there, 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, any evangelical hearing of that enlarged, there would be 30 committed people meeting together for a Bible study. It would be unheard of in those days.
Cool. And following upon the ministry of Bob Nelson and Jerry, we had very quickly 5 new converts, a home woman of 75 and 2 couples, and it's just been tremendous, and they've come into the fellowship and joined in very quickly. It's been just tremendous to see.
Great.
But it's been very much a process of some sowing and some reaping, and we feel very, very privileged to have been at the reaping end of the sowing.
Sowing in tears.
So to be up again, but interesting to see in connection with Larks, but by 1959, I think, and before that, there was a little prayer meeting in Larks, which I attended once with friends, run by UF people. A wee lady called Hannah, who still works in the baker's shop in the main street yonder. And that prayer meeting was in a house, first prayer meeting I'd ever been at in my life. I'd just on the brink of becoming a Christian at the time, and I've never forgotten it. And I wonder if these lads are there in answer to their prayers.
She's standing very strong as well.
Of course, the Manchurian Lads also ate after Wallace.
Yes.
Has been out here in England, but really, as far as I can hear, tremendous influence within the congregation and within the area. Since they've been enlarged, yeah. After, was it 41 years in Lochearn? 43. Tremendous. Well, I think that we should try to bring out any tensions that there are between different views, you know, just to be absolutely realistic. And I want you to do that, you see.
I find that your distinction between sectional interests and outreaching groups actually very helpful than anything else did. I think I may have confused the purpose of various groups, and to have that distinction made has helped me enormously, because my instinct has always been, for example, with our Women's Guild, to really try and encourage them. Hence, if I meet with any woman of that approximate age range who's maybe widowed, I would encourage her to join with the Women's Guild. Because I see a pastoral and possibly an evangelical outcome of that. And yet there are real tensions. There are people, there are groups I can see very clearly who are there just to look after themselves and not concerned with anything at all. And sometimes the two things are mixed together.
That's what makes me not a groupie man at all, because so many groups and so many areas. It's true in general. I think I said that in the paper with New Year. And churches in England particularly, and CUs have just been ruined, been rent asunder with groups, divisive groups, who with one here and one there, who just love the preeminence you see in their own little thing, rather in somebody's kitchen or living room, rather than gathering around. But that needn't be so, and I take it that there is a real... Alistair, there's a real loyalty to the fellowship, and your groups are people who really belong to the fellowship and are part of the family. Is that not so?
Yes, I think that groups of this kind ought to be seen to be outreach groups, essentially almost. Yes. Now, I know, of course, that they will serve the purpose of fellowship, but I think to safeguard them against an introverted fellowship, one has to keep the eyes going outwards. In terms of leadership, I think that if over the years people have been converted and have grown in the faith, it will be astonishing if we can't trust them with a group, you know, and to lead it wisely and within
the overall strategy of the whole congregation. And we're just really at the beginnings of this in West Isles, so I can't speak too much of that, but I could say certainly in the Gala Shields situation that I was never disappointed in the leadership. They led the groups consistently to a high level, and I was never unhappy with them from the point of view of divisiveness or anything else.
Oh, it's good to hear that.
One sets the sights of the thing, of course. You don't just start these things. You have to get your leaders together and talk it over and be sure that they understand what they're doing and that you understand what's in their minds too. So that there's a oneness about it right from the beginning. But then there has to be trust by the minister.
Yes. Yes, John.
After a period of 2 years, one or two of the younger women approached me just a week or two back about a young wives group, and my immediate reaction was to ask them if they wouldn't like to think rather in terms of a coffee evening, and I was more concerned that it should meet outside the church rather than inside. Are there dangers in entrusting folk who are both Christians and women folk in forming a meeting outside the church and outside the church premises as a quite definite and clear-cut outreach group?
Wouldn't it depend entirely on the leaders and what their motivation was and how far, as I was to say, you can trust them? I think if I can just give an and I think I've told the story here more than once, that early in our ministry, when we had the midweek service in the church, because they spoke about your Bible study and your prayer meeting, and I said, I'll soon sort that. So we took it into the church and had the organ, Mr. Ross, there, and it was a church affair, whether they liked it or not. And I gave it on occasions. I gave the midweek to men who had come around. One or two had been converted with us, one or two would come in, as people do, and some of them are sent by the Lord, some of them are sure sent by the other fellow. Jim Phillips said to me in those early days, that 46, 47, Jim, where in the world are you? Oh, you're hiding there. He said, you be careful what you're doing, giving these men, setting these men up in the pulpit, you see. I lost every one of them. They got cocky, and in time he was perfectly right. I lost every one of them. Now we must have a list of I don't know how many, 40, 50 men who take our midweek Bible study, and the last thing in the world I would ever expect would be any dare I call it insubordination rank. I don't that kind of thing is absolutely out, you see. So there would be a time, there's a long gap to, there would be it would take time before, whether it's long or short, before you could trust people, even if they've got gifts of leadership, you see, to be so thoroughly indoctrinated and committed to the Lord. And if we use the Romans phrase, sufficiently dead to self and ambition. This is the ruination of the Christian church. People furthering their own interests and seeking a sphere of service to satisfy their egos. This is the great danger of groups, you see. But if that's avoided, then the whole thing is contributing. It's doing two things. It's contributing to the family, and yet it's outreaching, and it's the outreaching part that you are deeply concerned about, and I would be too. You see, we have many such groups, if you could call them that, in Aberdeen. We have folk with fingers in Christian pies all over the place. Scripture Union galore, Crusaders galore, Sunday schools. We run two Sunday schools, one at Bridgerton and the other at Shenoxley. A whole lot of other things like that. That kind of outreach, that's a different sort of thing. You see, we can trust these people to do those things and be respected by the various ministers who help them. St. Maga Cathedral, you see, one one of the boys speaking to him last night, who runs a Sunday school for St. Michael Cathedral, to Bridget on. That's another sort of thing. And that's certainly outreach, because it's gathering the children together.
Mr. Steele, as someone else who has very much appreciated your emphasis on family and found it very helpful in the last year or two, presumably one of the things that we're saying behind all that is that God wants a distinctive people, and that the problem with the sectional groups is that they are not distinctive people, because they are not pursuing wholeheartedly the purpose of God. And our problem is either accepting the situation as we find it when we go in, to try and create distinctive Christian leadership and members of these sectional groups so that they will increasingly become an integral part of God's work, mm-hmm. or through prayer and other means, sometimes direct action, may it be said, to bring about a situation where these interests, by God's initiative, not by ours, fall away. I have seen four groups fall away and I haven't lifted a finger. But one of them's come back. And we've had a great flower show this year, and God used it. So that I must be open to God's purpose, but I believe that what God wants is a distinctive family, because after all, no other faith, no other group can offer this. And it's to see God's timing and to let God do it. Although we may have to be involved in actually saying no. And I thank God I haven't been involved in any of these things, that God has done it all.
Well, we'll maybe start and have a holy hallelujah flower show and go. Yeah.
Mr. Still? Is it possible you invited us to share tensions?
Yes, yes.
Would you like to share a tension that I feel? I do, hoping for forgiveness and with apology. It cut me to the heart when, in an aside, you said that people dressed in ministerial robes were looking like clowns. And I'm afraid, I ask forgiveness if it's that way, but I'm very proud to wear my ministerial robes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I share that, I beg the forgiveness of the meeting if that's, and I don't want to cause distress to you as leader or disrespect, but I simply, you invited me to share the tension that I felt, and I must say I feel very proud to wear the ministerial robes.
I'm sorry, that was too strong an expression to use. It was said somewhat facetiously in a private company, you know, but
speak from the tape.
Eh? No, I wouldn't have you take that all that seriously. That's putting it extremely. But one wears robes at presbytery occasions, inductions, and this kind of thing. Did the other week, and marriages. I never marry anyone without all that I've got to wear, which isn't. I'm not beribboned, you see, behind. I've no colours, just black and white. I think thinking of the youngsters of today, you see, that kind of thing, going into a church and all its fine oak and the whole thing is completely foreign to them. And although they've got to learn about those things too, I'm sure, it takes them a long time. And all that I want to do is to go more than halfway, if I can, you see. Come on, come in, your dirty jeans and your own kempt hair and this kind of thing.
Yes, the Pope is doing the same.
Is he? I haven't seen him in dirty white yet.
No, but I mean, he's gorgeously and ecclesiastically robed up to the gunnels, but still he reaches out to
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I think we've got to remember
though on the other hand, that there are a lot of unconverted Kirky folk who are put off by our not wearing robes and collars, and they've got souls to be saved as well as the young folk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a balance there. I've folk in my congregation who have been very upset at the departure of the old tradition of elders being dressed up in mourning coats for communion. So that's two sides to a question.
One of the hairy jeans wearing characters said to me on the day of his wedding in Sandyford, when I appeared in all my ministerial grandeur, that he had been longing to see his minister properly dressed. And for the comfort of the fellow up in the corner here, I would say to him that on one occasion, quite a long time ago, I was well and truly lectured by the Reverend William Still for going into the pulpit without my robe.
Mr. Still, I think on the level of tension, I think you said today it's going to be easier for us to do the things that you did in a much shorter time. I think we've got to be very careful about that. I think the danger for us all is to take a pace too quickly without knowing exactly what the Lord's doing. To try and do something that fits into the pattern that's prevalent at this particular moment, and not to remember there's been so many changes, and what each of us is to do is to go at our own pace with our own congregation in the way that the Lord's leading us. You've made it so much easier for us, but that's not made us any more mature, any more quickly. We as individuals and we as congregations have got to learn how to cope with our development. And that's something you can only learn through experience and time. And I think that we've got to take the time that it took, perhaps, your situation to do that.
Yes, I wouldn't want you to come with patterns. I don't want anybody to copy anything as I do, except that it was Paul tells people to imitate him, and we know exactly what he means, except in anything that is biblical or has been proved to be blessed, with modifications and applications according to different situations. Now, when I go elsewhere to preach, I ask the minister what is done. Now, I haven't always done this, but I do it now. I do exactly what he does in the matter of dress. At John Smith's in Gaelough, he said he wore his collar all the time. I could wear my sports suit on Saturday night. We had a lovely Bible study with a group. Families in the Highlands were really lovely. But on Sunday, something a little more sober and the collar. If he'd said robes, I would have taken my robes. And that would apply to anywhere. I think that's why.
Surely, though, as we share with our people what's going on in Scotland in our prayer groups, it is easier for us in some ways, because we're not imposing something on them from without. We're saying, now, this seems to be the kind of thing that God is doing, and you know, we're plugging away gently. I do believe that if we find an openness, I've certainly found that they've been amazed. My session clerk, when he met you at teen, remember that? Came back, he began to see, now this, you know, this chap is just not an odd boy. You know, there's other people who are odd boys, isn't there?
Well, he is, but never mind.
But if you can finish, sorry, I think there's two things here. There's a fear of tradition that we have to cope with in Scotland, which I believe is 50% okay, 50% not okay. And there's a fear of imitation. Now, young men often fear to imitate because they don't want to do something just because somebody else has done it who's older and wiser. But I must admit that
we have to swallow our pride and say it's, we don't do it because Mr. Still said it or Mr. Phillips said it, but because it's good and because it's right, and that's why we do have to do things.
I'm sure there's a lot of paralysis amongst some of you chaps just because of this. If Willie Still does it, we can't do it, see, because people say he's doing it because Willie Still. People have been, there are ministers here and others who have been charged with being my echoes and mannerisms and voice and all the rest of it, and they've had to live through that until they have developed. We all learn from one another, I hope. I've told this before. I can recognize inflections in my own voice that I learned from Cosmo Gordon Lang, the Archbishop of Canterbury, when I was a young man. And a whole lot of things like the charge of plagiarism in music and literature. We all learn from one another, and I think it's something very, very poor and very, very weak. Anybody who wouldn't learn something from me or from anybody else if they see anything it's good. And I don't see why that shouldn't go on, because I feel younger than I ever did in all my life.
So, Stuart, you've given an idea, because some of the bit of the privilege to be here at the prayer meeting in Gilkinson on the Saturday evening, when you're talking about families being there. Now, how many would be there, and how many families would be there? Because I think it would be encouraging to know this. I think one of the other difficulties that some of us face is that, for instance, on Monday night is my Bible study prayer meeting evening. I would take it as a Saturday evening if I want to make a family evening.
Yes.
Whereas that some of us, when we went into our congregation, if that was the night that was free, then that was the night that we, have come in on. And therefore, with me, that's the nature of main right too. And therefore, for families to come together on a Monday evening, it's not as easy as seeing a Saturday.
Oh, no, it's very difficult.
But if you give us an idea of the number and the number of families within that group.
It's difficult to say, it varies. Not a great many, mind you. Some with one child, some with two, three, four. Several families with four. 9 or 10 families, I would say, at the most. Because it's not a huge company, you see. What the hall wouldn't hold more than the way it's set, about 50, 60?
75.
Is that right? But you see, a lot of them are youngsters.
That's what it gets so far.
Yes. I hope in both senses. lots of single people there, you see, lots of students and nurses and this kind of thing. But this is, it's a hodgepodge, we're all mixed together, and some of the dear old ladies, you see. Not many old men, just two of us. He's older than me. He's 74. Yeah. I'm not 70 yet.
Maybe we should mention that families with the younger children do leave the prayer meeting.
Oh, yes. We pray until after 10, could be 10:15, you see, from 7:30. One or two things before that. That's our Saturday evening. We actually sing a psalm at the beginning and have a little meditation, short meditation. We're running through the whole Psalter just now, and a meditation on that, and then worship for about 20 minutes of prayer. Nobody's allowed to intercede. You're worshiping the earth, to worship the Lord on the basis of His word, you see, and that's the most precious time of the whole week. That's when we just rise, just wonderful. And then we have news that can take half an hour, and then prayer for the rest of it, intercessory prayer right on. And this is an awkward thing from two points of view. We lose our best men, our best elders, fathers, beginning to slip up from the back of 9 until 9:30 with their children, you see. And that's a great loss. Our Duncan Martin used to pray right around the islands and right up the west coast of Scotland, and he used to go home with his children, you see, although they're growing up a little, and that's a great loss, you see. But I see that this pleases me. Some of the families, as the children are growing a little older, they can say a little, you see. But take Bill Harrell here, his two little children. What's Rachel? 9.
Bill,
8.
And Melody, the one that this surgery 7, you see. Now, they go to, you'll be reading this in the Gilchrist and Rekha, because what Deborah said here in the spring is going into the next letter, because I think everybody should read it. They go to bed on Saturday afternoon with their consent and cooperation, the two little girls, to be able for the whole prayer meeting on Saturday night. You mightn't approve of that, and some of your wives wouldn't approve of it, but it sure works, and they're the happiest two girls you could meet. It's all a matter of getting children to cooperate and see why you're doing. You explain. Bill's just saying, come down to the car. He says, you need to take a lot of time with your children. Spend more time with your children. Explain to them why you're doing this, and you see, and giving them choices too. But then you see, if you've explained and you thoroughly explain to them what the whole point of the thing, they begin to understand. Say, oh yes, Daddy, oh yes, Mummy, we'll do that. We'll try it.
Could I say something that I think a lot of them are thinking?
We'll maybe test you on that, Mr. Phillips.
Well, I would question whether that is natural for children. A family is a natural unit, and I question whether it's natural for children to go to bed an afternoon in order to be able to be at a prayer meeting. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's unnatural. I'm sure some of you are thinking it.
let me just respond, yes, to that, since I'm one. When we came to Gilchrist, the girls were 4 and 5, and we rotated going to prayer meeting. I went one week and Deb would go the next, and the girls would stay home. And then we decided, well, we'll take the girls and try them out, because people would leave at 9, and we left at 9 o'clock, and the girls just gradually grew to a point where they wanted to stay through, but they needed their sleep, and so we instituted the nap.
The biblical picture is boys and girls playing in the streets rather than sitting in prayer meetings. And I think there's something there that needs to be looked at. I'm not against children being at prayer meetings. I think it's more healthy that some of the other kids at Gilchrist go out halfway through and go down to the chip shop. Now, that registers with me as being a natural children's reaction. And I think healthy. I'm not so happy about the other one. But maybe I'm the only one that's not happy.
No. Is it not true just that children are very different, and therefore we have to treat our children differently? That's the one thing that would worry me, that, you know, if we were to go home to our congregations and try and force this on our congregation, you've got all sorts of tensions, especially amongst the mothers, because if your mothers whose children just would not sit for that time, and we've got a long time to be trained to do it, and other children will do it very quickly and spontaneously.
Yes.
And I think it's wrong to try and inflict that on the parents again, and make them feel very guilty about it. Children are different. And I think you just let children, if someone wants to go and sit in a parenting all night, then that's great. But not all will be so cooperative or so willing.
Yes, but the implication in this, you see, is that this ought to be the ideal and the norm. And it's that I'm questioning.
We asked our girls if they wanted to go to prayer meeting after, as Mr. Still mentioned, you share things with them, you explain what prayer meeting is, you explain that there is cost involved, and that no one really enjoys prayer meeting on one level. that there is sacrifice. And then we ask the girls, what do you want to do? And if they had said we'd like to continue leaving early, then I think we would have respected that. I think it is, as you say, a matter of the children, and parents need to know their children.
I don't hope I'm not opting out of something that is a challenge, but in Jonathan Edwards' works, he's got an account of surprising conversions, and there's one account of a very young girl who had an amazing spiritual ministry for her years, but he put it into the section, an account of surprising conversions, and I wonder if possibly your children are exceptional. And I just think of my two, and they're considerably younger than yours.
I don't know. I couldn't possibly answer that, because I just know my children. And so whether this is something that parents have neglected, or whether it's something that the children are unusual, it's something that needs to be worked out. I think the parents are better equipped to answer that for themselves than to lay the onus on the children. There is a degree of control and discipline exercise in the home that is very costly. It does take time, and time from what I would rather be doing at other things, time for my wife. But I think that we're best friends in the best way with our children, and so it pays rewards.
On this question again of the children's facility, I'm thinking in particular of ourselves as ministers and children growing up in Manses. You know, where this kind of situation would be, you know, families praying together, wouldn't it be expected that the minister's family would be present, as it were, you know, to be an example within the situation? And I'm sure of you that many have experienced this kind of tension, where there is the danger of overdosing our children, and where, in a sense, you know, they've got to be, and where, in a sense, they are living in the face, you know, of the church all the time, within their own home. And those coming to the door, the telephone going, the father's office, the father's at home, in a sense, father's not at home because he's in his study. And perhaps, in a sense, it may be all right when they're a bit younger, when we can sort of say, you do this and you do that. But is there not the danger of a rebellion coming? Rather than, as it were, you know, growing up and doing that, so here, in a sense, perhaps they feel that they're getting too much of that, and they kick against it. Because I think, I mean, the man's, whether they like it or not, the man's, in one way, is a different home from our homes. I think because of the nature of our calling and our work, and our involvement with people in the parish and so on.
Yes. Yes, I think this kind of thing needs to be started very young. That's the thing. If you see it, you see, coming from the Highlands there, it was families of all the different ages that trooped in, not a large company, but families, and they're accustomed to that. And our Highland families who came just as natural for them, and some of the other families have seen it, and some of the Aberdeen families and some coming in from the south have seen that and have adopted it. This man's been a little over 2 years here from America, and he saw the beginnings of what we were doing, and they have fitted in as well as others. Not every family is fitted in, and not all would agree with that, and some would agree with what Jim says and some of the rest you say. But it's not all demure little girls who do this, by any means.
Do the same, do the same families, they come see you on a Wednesday night and twice on a Sunday as well? I mean, do they come consistently to the school?
Yes. As I say, not children so much on Wednesday for reasons, the same reason as you spoke about Monday. Yes, Bob spoke about Monday. For that reason, you see. And it would be unreasonable, you see. The children have homework, and some of them live far out, you see, and busy parents in the course of the week. But Saturday is the ideal night for that kind of thing, you see, for a family occasion. I think, yes, Frank.
I think we're slightly bogging down, slightly off the question, this question of how one's going to Germany, etc. I think the point that I see is that the prayer meeting and such like, as we have it at present, is working as a group where people do feel at home, sufficiently at home to come on that kind of basis. I think the midweek service also people are feeling at home, and similarly on Sundays. And I think that's the importance of the change in the familial kind of structure. I think, in a sense, Mr. Stills mentioned that there are a number of folk now who do midweek Bible studies. That's had a distinct effect on the office bearers. We understand the kind of pressures that go on to the minister, going up the pulpit steps, or preparing for them. We can understand the kind of ministerial pressures that will be a bit better. That makes us, to that extent, I hope, better friends. And we know the pressures that are going on Jim Sinton, the Beagle when he does it, Alan Masson, the Fish Merchant, Duncan Martin, and Kenton. We're all going through this kind of common experience, and again, that makes us friends. And I think, in a sense, that transformation working through the church is very important. The church, in a sense, and the deacon's court in the Kirk session are not arenas that we come into with our masks on to go through certain stylized rituals and then depart quickly. But they're places where friends meet together and first in the germs and talk out the problems of the church, talk about it elsewhere. So the whole thing is operating in an arena of friendship. I think the problem with the sectional groups is that the sectional groups that can arise, and I've seen this, at work in the faculty, for example. You get people that get to know each other very well, but they don't know the other sections. So they tend to react in a largish meeting as members of one little political party, and they score points off each other. And if they can take what is being said by the other group as being an insult to them, they'll do it. They play roles. Now, what we are trying to get towards is not playing roles, but just being ourselves in the church as a whole. Not well put, but I think that's kind of something
to say. That was helpful, Frank, but Jim has raised the question of what is natural for children.
Yeah.
I was brought up in a home for missionaries' children, and prayer meetings were very much the order of the day for us all, even open air witness at the age of 11, 12, 13. And looking back, I think many of us attained a spirituality that was false, in that it wasn't natural for a child, to do these things. And the result of that, in many cases, was strong rebellion later on. In other cases, one had to unlearn an awful lot and rediscover
the good of these things for oneself as an adult. And it is a question, I think, of what is natural for a child. Looking back, I don't think prayer meetings, early morning prayer meetings, open air witness, this sort of thing, was natural for a group of children. But some of us came through it unscathed, but others didn't.
Yes, that's true. I know that's true, and I know.
I think on the analogy of the family, there are situations in human family